Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words. This is Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway. Today, I'm holding just a very, very cool cookbook, and it's written by a chef named Aaliyah Lee Kong. It's called Exotic Table, Flavors, Inspiration, and Recipes from Around the World to Your Kitchen. She's on the line, but just before I have her start talking, I thought I'd, if she doesn't mind, read a little bit from the introduction of the book. So this comes about shortly after the author is briefly describing her mixed heritage, which is Indo-Pakistani and Tanzanian, and how that influences her culinary repertoire, and also how it reflects her husband's mixed heritage, who is Trinidadian by way of Venezuela, Spain, and China. So the author writes, "We are incredibly fortunate to live in a time when different ingredients and spices are readily accessible, and when other cultures' foods have commingled and entered the American dialogue. What might have been coined exotic just 10 years ago might not be so today. I cook quite simply the way I eat. My style is not about elevation or modernism. It's just my personal way of preserving my food traditions. I'm not a purist, and my travels, heritage, family, or even culinary training serve merely as inspiration. I do not declare that anything I cook is exactly per the traditional. I work with what I can find, have on hand, or simply prefer flavor-wise. I encourage you to follow the same idea as you read through my stories and try the recipes in this book." Very cool. We got Aaliyah Lee Kong on the line. How are you?
Good. How are you, Kathy?
I'm good. Thanks. So congratulations on your first cookbook.
Thank you so much.
It's so exciting to me. I really love it. Just flipping through like the first section, which is like the pantry staples or spice cabinet section, and seeing sambal oleg and harissa and what else? Ras El Hanout the same section. It's just like, wow. Who I don't know. It's a first. Definitely, it's a first.
Thank you. Yeah.
A brave cookbook.
I would say that that's a good, just you even saying that, it's a good reflection of how varied culinary influences can really be and how fun it can be.
Yeah, it is fun. And, so you grew up and cooking all these different flavors, and I love how you say in the introduction that sometimes you're different. Each parent, their culinary references would sort of just mingle into the same dish, and you weren't even sure anymore which one came from which, which ingredient.
True. No, it's totally true. I mean, I think for me, they spoke different. It's heritage can be so nuanced, mm-hmm. and even though my parents sort of look alike, they came from different parts of the world and had very different influences growing up, and their cultural practices, language, food, they were different. And so, yeah, you're right. I never knew, in each language which word, belonged to which, and food, too. It's kind of mashed up.
That is so funny.
And I think, now that I'm married to my husband, who is from Brooklyn, with the Trinidadian, mm-hmm. Venezuelan, Spanish, Chinese influences, my child will have no idea what's going on.
In a good way.
In a very good way.
That's so cool. So can you spell out anything that would be the quintessential comfort food to you?
I think comfort foods, it's usually childhood related. I think mm-hmm. for a lot of people, it sort of brings you back. And for me, that is varied, East mm-hmm. African curries, that are like coconut based were big in my family, but my mom also made these killer chocolate butterscotch cookies and mm-hmm. flan and, or did a really great, Indian inspired, tenderloin stir fry that she makes, and she still makes when I go home.
It's just, that is so cool.
You know, when it's, I think food tastes different in different hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it's like my mom's hands carry the most comfort.
Right, right, yeah. And, you know, it's true when you said that, you know, your both of your parents, one is Indo-Pakistani and one is Tanzanian, but each of these cuisines in themselves have so many different influences from other cuisines and cultures throughout history.
Yeah.
Like, so it's really just everything.
Yeah.
Something. I don't know. I'm still wrapping my head around it, but it's so cool. And did you have any awkward experiences with your, you know, brown paper lunch bag going to school and bringing out this something that was not like everyone else's?
Oh, no one wanted to train with me. I could not get a train for the life of me. I was jealous of like Lunchables and crustless sandwiches. I was not. We were not wasting crusts in our house. I was not able to get those. But you know, it was really, you know, whatever we had for dinner the night before between two pieces of Luscious Wonder Bread. So it was like curry.
Well, there you go.
Keema or different, you know, different things that we'd have, and it would be between Wonder Bread and that was pretty much it. And
with no crust,
no one wanted it, but it was tasty.
That is so funny. Yeah, you know, I, you know, this really speaks to me because I'm also sort of mixed, half Chinese and not quite as mixed as you, but and yeah, like that question always kind of brings up awkward memories with, you know, everyone I've spoken to about it.
Well, what did you have in your lunch?
You know, as you mentioned it, white sandwich bread with char rofen, which is not rofen. What am I talking about? It's this like shredded like roast pork thingy that's very strange.
That sounds delicious. That sounds like you could make a truck and right now, and people would love it.
Oh yeah, right. What's up with that? Like every truck is some crazy hybrid of something.
Yeah.
And speaking of which, like, how do you, so obviously not everybody is, you know, these different influences come naturally to them in the kitchen. And, you know, you say very generously in the introduction that we should, you know, just have fun with it and play around and not worry about being a purist. But, how would you encourage people to feel, well, I guess I just said not be afraid, but you know, there's you know, I even feel a little bit of trepidation about being respectful to traditional cultures when infusing some flavors from the cuisines that I'm, you know, not really sure about even the traditional versions of.
Right. Well, I mean, I think at the end of the day, if you're not saying you're creating a traditional dish or trying to recreate a traditional dish, you know, like I said, it's not about elevating some cuisine, which I think I find that really condescending. You know, it's not about that. It's paying homage, but through your way of cooking, and it's really about seeking flavors out or seeking a specific ingredient out or you know, a technique that you see is used in a different cuisine and using it the way that you want to use it. You know, it could be as simple as taking a really great spice blend. You know, in my cookbook I have a roast chicken dish and I use a Middle Eastern za'atar.
Za'atar, I saw that. Ooh.
Yeah, which is just a spice blend with thyme and sesame seeds and this tart berry called sumac, a powder made from that. And I think using that on some roast chicken is delicious. It's not really about respect or disrespect. You know, it's about taking that flavor and playing with it in a way that works for your lifestyle, for, you know, if you have kids at home, something they're going to eat too, because, you know, you have to feed your family first and foremost. And I think, you know, I really think that you can do that in a way that's, again, fun and respectful.
Right. And
well,
it sounds delicious.
Line, for sure.
And now that you mention it, like that za'atar spice blend doesn't sound too far from herb de Provence that you might spread
exactly.
on a roast chicken.
Yeah, it is.
Very clever.
And that was, actually, that's what I thought of when I did it, so it's funny that you say that.
Awesome. We speak some similar language, hopefully. So, you know, as you're saying, like, elevating, do you see some chefs kind of using traditions and, I mean, sorry, using techniques with a sort of abandon and sort of trying to elevate them? Is that a certain trend that you see happening?
You know, I don't know so much that it's the chef's intention to do mm-hmm. that, but maybe when people talk about it afterwards, right. it becomes that.
I see.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't necessarily know that someone starts out that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can run the risk if you're taking another cuisine that you don't, that's not necessarily your indigenous or your, you know, the cuisine that you know,
no,
and
yeah.
then you try to sort of turn it on its head. I think it can come off that way.
Yeah.
But I think intent is really important. If
right.
that's not what you're trying to do, then you know, it doesn't even matter.
Right. It's so easy to misread intent sometimes. It's just...
Exactly.
How can you
exactly.
even do that? Like, one of the recipes that really stood out to me in your book was the Trinidadian Chinese wonton soup. And first of all, I love wonton soup, and my mom makes it all the time. And the Trinidadian version, I like, just glancing at the name, I wouldn't have, like, really understood it. But then when you describe it and then talk about how there's a large, you know, Trinidadian Chinese population in Trinidad, and this is their version, sounds really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, well, it's the complete, it's explanation for my last name, Lee Kong.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Chinese side of the Trinidadian family my husband comes from. And, you know, he used to take me, he grew up in Crown Heights, Bed-Stuy, on the border in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of Trini places there. And, you know, you see it. You see Trini Indian food, you see Trini Chinese food, you know, and this was a wonton soup that he had me eating.
Mm-hmm.
I spiced it up a little bit more
mm-hmm.
than what I had, but it definitely came from there. That's a little spot that I used to go to, and it's delicious.
I love
the fried wontons are amazing, too.
Yeah. I love the sound of it because it has a sort of traditional pork, minced pork filling, but it also has the scotch bonnet chilies and a little lime and cilantro. It sounds great.
Yeah. Yeah, thank
nice.
You.
And I live in Crown Heights, but I haven't seen it. I haven't seen this, so I need to find it.
Okay.
What's up with that?
It's on Nostrand.
Oh. Huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe if I speak Chinese.
It's called Trini Roti House. It's pretty good.
Sweet.
And there's another place called Trini Go. So.
So, you know, oh, and another dish that I was just inspired by in itself, it could be in any cookbook, for whatever purpose, was your kale salad, and you had a really great tip about massaging the leaves. So when they're raw, yeah. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I try to. I mean, cooking all this food, I really do try to get my raw and my roughage in, and, mm-hmm. and juice, and do different things. And I love kale, but it can be so. But I'm not a bitter person. I just mm-hmm. don't like bitter foods in general, and I find kale can be really bitter. So. It's kind of a cool technique, you know, the lemon juice and salt kind of and olive oil, break it down a little bit, just start to break down the leaves. And when you, and it just becomes so much, I think it just becomes great and really palatable as a salad after that.
I never.
What I love about that, sorry.
No, I never thought of that.
Recipe,
it sounds
so,
great.
Yeah, is I did a pomegranate vinaigrette with it, and I use pomegranate molasses, which I think is becoming a little bit more popular. I mean, you can find it at Whole Foods and that sort of thing. But fruit molasses in the Middle East are used to sweeten things, and they were used when sugar was really expensive, and during peak season, fruits were cooked down, the must and the juice of fruits were cooked down to these syrups that they called molasses.
Mm-hmm.
There's pomegranate, date, grape. And so in the book, I have a recipe for how to make your own pomegranate molasses using palm juice. Basically, you just cook down 100% palm juice, and you get the same thing, so you can make it at home.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, it's funny you mentioned that, because I had a Louisa Shafia on the show, the new Persian Kitchen cookbook, and she talked about pomegranate molasses, and I never heard of it before, and now I feel like I'm seeing it here and there, or maybe it just, I'm noticing it.
Yeah.
Finally.
That's definitely one of those things when it gets pointed out, and that always happens, and you start seeing it everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, and it sounds great for this salad in particular. Okay, so how do you feel about the word fusion food?
You know, I think it's tough because I don't necessarily. I know that there's fusion cuisines out there, and people sort of own that when they cook it.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, when I travel, I see so many cuisines that come out of different peoples and different cultures. So, you know, when I was in Peru, Peruvian food to us may sound like one cuisine, but it's really, you know, you're in the indigenous people that were there, the Spanish conquistadors with Moorish wives, the Chinese, the Japanese with their ceviches and tiraditos, and now that cuisine is this amalgamation of immigration and war and movement, and I think that's really honest, and, and actually that's what I see happening. I mean, America is so young compared to a lot of these other cultures, and we don't necessarily realize that, but that's what I see happening here. I mean, I see that we have so many different people, you know, in one place, and people are trying to hold on to their heritage, but also sort of incorporate what's new around them. So for me, fusion, I mean, sure, fusion cuisine, I guess, exists in that sense, but it really just sort of depends on how, if it's a concerted effort to put two cuisines together that don't necessarily normally go together versus what happens naturally in a place. Because of different people.
Yeah, I'm always confused by that term. I mean, it makes sense on paper, but then, like, there's all these, like, I don't know, restaurants that are like, we're fusion. It's like, what? So anyway, I don't know. So let's get back to a lot more talking about Exotic Table right after a quick little musical interlude.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
All right, we're back chatting with Aaliyah Lee Kong of Exotic Table, the cookbook. So we were talking a little bit about the word fusion food and mixed feelings on that. But how about, you know, why did you decide on exotic as the kind of moniker for this cookbook or your culinary repertoire?
Well, you know, exotic for me, it's a bit tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
You know, the reality is I'm hoping to make... We're hoping to allow people a glimpse into some other cultures and see how accessible and how relatable those ingredients can be or those spices can be. And I try to take, you know, dishes that are Western at heart and then infuse them with these spices and ingredients or traditions.
So, in other words, not so exotic table.
Exactly.
Exactly. And one example, maybe, of that is your recipe for chicken and biscuits. And how did you come up with that?
I grew up in Florida. Florida is not necessarily considered the South, but it sort of still is. So I love, like, biscuits and fried chicken and, you know, shepherd's corn pudding and all these things. And so chicken and biscuits is something that I love to make in the winter. And I was just sort of inspired by a Provençal-style stew that I had and really wanted to infuse it with herbs de Provence and a little banyuls, which I love using and cooking with, and it came out really great. I was like, that's going in the cookbook. Score moments in the kitchen.
So this book is really like a lot of like creative whims that you've had and then perfected.
Yeah,
sounds like.
Absolutely.
What do you think is like the most popular dish that maybe you've cooked for people for in restaurants that was like a big hit that made you think I got to do more of these?
Well, I think when I cook at home, it's usually I think my corn pudding is probably something that really kind of
do tell. I have ears
really like
of corn. I don't know what to do with.
Well, this you can definitely. I use a little smoked mozzarella in there. It's like smoky and creamy and a little bit spicy from some chilies, and you kind of hit all parts of your tongue and still that sweet corn. It's perfect to do. I know it seems like more of a warm weather dish, but when corn's in season now, it's like it's perfect. It's
wow!
Perfect.
So the smoked mozzarella is like melted in with it and makes it creamy.
Yeah.
Creamy? Oh, my God. I never thought of that. It must be fun and, like, kind of like, you know, like a pizza is all sticky and, like, pull. Yeah. Okay.
Good.
Excellent. you know, this is your first cookbook. What other projects do you have maybe up your sleeves?
Well, not quite a project, but I just gave birth to a little girl a couple weeks ago.
Congratulations.
So that was my... Thank you. That was a project, actually. That was a project. I don't know what I'm saying. But other than that, you know, my cookbook coming out is sort of the thing that I'm focused on in November. I also filmed a pilot that aired on the Food Network called Chef Marks the Spot. And we're still sort of in conversations about that. And I'm still at Janoon, where I'm a culinary creative director and a chef there. So that's been taking up a lot of my time.
And can we find any of these recipes at Janoon on the menu?
I didn't pull any of the ones from the menu into the cookbook, but there are a bunch of recipes at Janoon that I've done. And you were saying what popular ones. My Kerala shrimp curry is probably...
Carolina? What'd you say?
Kerala, from Kerala, from South India. The Kerala shrimp curry that I have on the menu there is probably... we do it with lobster and with shrimp. It's probably one of my more popular dishes there.
Wow. Oh, I love how you have these, like, kind of vignettes throughout the cookbook and... you know, like little stories. And in one part, you talk about going to a friend's home in New Orleans and just really bonding over making etouffee, jambalaya, and all these Cajun recipes and Creole recipes, and finding that, food is just like really universal because these recipes really... Or tell me about that, because why did you include that?
Well, I have this really colorful friend of mine, and he has been he is New Orleans... you know, do or die. And he's been saying, you have to go. And one day I was like, all right, let's just go. So I went down there and he set me up with his aunt and she just kind of schooled me in the kitchen on all these different dishes. And it was so fun. And just hearing how people grow up and their influences and how they take food that their family makes and make it their own. It's kind of just like this universal, like this universal truth that it just keeps moving. And I just really enjoyed it and learned so much about sort of Creole versus Cajun food and the origins of those and Leah Chase and what she's done there. And it's exciting. It was really exciting and really fun.
Yeah, and where it came up in the book, it also just made me think of how many parallels there are in every cuisine of building flavors with what's available and what's abundant and how much in common a lot of these exotic, you know, quote unquote cuisines really do have in their essence. So
yeah.
Cool.
I mean, there's really a whole, the American Museum of Natural History just had an exhibit and it actually just closed on food and people and migration. And it's amazing how, you know, a cuisine cooked in China, let's take and how it moved, it through to Turkey, you know, and how what was available there, or if you look at Mexico and dishes that we think of as Mexican, you know, tomatoes weren't indigenous to Mexico, neither were chilies, neither was beef. You know, how did
squash.
That cuisine kind of change and move, and how did it get there, and how did it become what it is? It is crazy when you think about it.
I was remarking with a friend about, like, avocado in this little Japanese restaurant. I'm like, how come nobody else in Asia is eating avocado so much? I don't know. I would like to know. what would you say are some, like, upcoming trends in food in the restaurant world or in just popular food culture, like ingredients maybe, or a dish, or maybe certain cuisines? You have any...
Yeah. I mean, I think for a long time, sort of this idea of foraging and what's local has been resonating. And it's always been interesting to me because when I travel, it's like, that's all you have. You know, you have what's locally available. You have the seasons and what's in the market. And people just eat that way naturally. It's not something that's sort of forced upon them by a trend. But it's been interesting to see that's sort of what's been going on. But I also think that there is a little bit of I wouldn't say a backlash per se, but sort of a moving away from really technical cuisine and really theoretical food to kind of more casual. And you're seeing a lot of chefs who are burnt out in these, you know, Michelin-starred kitchens and want to open up something that's small and theirs and represents food that they love to eat. And so I think you see that, you know, and it's I think that's really exciting. Even someone like a David Chang who kind of has taken things and done them in a way that blends his background and his travels and what he likes to eat. I think it's a really beautiful thing to see.
Right, and it's more intimate. Also about, you know, what you were saying about like the local food, local ingredients, forage ingredients, you know, there might be a stigma about exotic food needing to have this like extensive international pantry of stuff that you need in order to whip things up. What would you say to help out the person who might feel like they don't have enough of these sauces or condiments or whatever?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of that is a lot of what I make in my book, at least, you can access at, you know, a local market or at a, you know, small ethnic grocer if you have one near you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I certainly didn't try to have people trekking all over the place or ordering things on Amazon or wherever to get those ingredients. And that's why I do recipes like that pomegranate molasses,
yeah,
where you can kind of make it at home.
I never knew that.
But I think, you know, I would just tell people to experiment and to try things out. And I tried to put a lot of substitutions in there. So, you know, if you can't find Mexican chocolate, you can just take some chocolate and some cinnamon and call it a day. Mm-hmm. And not worry yourself too much about that. You know, mm-hmm. it's chocolate cake. So, you know, how you can substitute things or use things that you can find at your local market, you know. I tried to do that wherever possible, too.
Cool. So more about those trends, what are some upcoming trends that you would maybe like to see happen with food?
I hope to see people, I mean, selfishly for me, I'd love to see people really cook, you know, food that they ate growing up. And you know, I think culinary students now really sort of span the gamut in terms of cultures, cultural backgrounds, and that sort of thing. So I think it's really exciting to see people take what they know and use technique that they learn and come up with something new. I think there's a lot of cuisines to be discovered that way.
Yeah, instead of just learning like the classic French techniques and then just calling it a day or something.
Yeah, I mean, you can learn classic French technique, but you know, I work at an Indian restaurant. If I tried to put a French technique on every curry that's out there, you know, it's not going to taste the same. It just isn't. And maybe that would be good in some ways, and maybe it wouldn't in others. But it's worth the experimentation to see, I guess.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be always be like, you know, French. So, what are some favorite recipes of the moment that are great to make in summer? I know you mentioned the corn pudding, which I'm definitely scoping out. And you have this grilled corn, which I see has a streak of green chili butter and toasted coconut. That's
a fun
variation for the grill, you know, cookouts.
Yeah. That's kind of like my Mexican corn, East African style.
Love it.
Really. I also love, I did from another vegetable, the summer squash with hazelnuts and brown butter and fresh tomatoes that you roast, a really simple dish. And I love salt baking fish, which you can do, you know, either in the oven or you can do that on the grill too, which is such a simple, simple technique that has like incredible, incredible results. You just, you know, it's salt and egg whites. And you pack it over a fish and bake it. And when you crack that open after the fish is done, it's like tender, spoonable fish.
Really?
It's delicious. It's really great.
So you could just kind of like make a sandcastle over this whole fish.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
A salt sandcastle.
That sounds super
and
fun.
Bake it up. It's so good.
And it's not too salty in the end?
It's not, actually. It just gives it the right amount of salt. And I like to do like a pesto I use chermoula with it. And
remind me what chermoula is. That those little grains?
It's kind of like a pesto. It has different herbs in it. It really just depends on you know, where you're coming from
and what herbs are going on. Yeah,
a lot of cilantro and parsley. You know, there's garlic. It's a North African fish marinade, and I use it kind of like a pesto at the end. A little turmeric, cumin, ginger, lemon. It's again, these are all stuff you can get at your local grocery store. Mm. So, you know, but it's, and you just make it in the blender in like 30 seconds. It's a great, great kind of North African pesto, if you will.
Summery and fresh. Well, I can't wait to try that one. And most of the recipes in this book. It looks like that's about all the time we have, but thank you for joining.
And thank you, Kathy.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure, and I'm so excited for the book, and I hope everyone gets their hands on it, and they can check it out at Exotic Table, or is it AaliyahLeeKong.com? What's your website?
It's AaliyahLeeKong.com, and it's on Amazon right now, Exotic Table, as well as BarnesandNobles.com.
Excellent. Well, have a great week.
Thank you. You too.
And thanks, everyone here at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.